Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. We all know that the mind is a powerful thing, but our guest, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Joseph Hallinan, will tell us just how powerful. His new book, Kidding Ourselves, explores how we deceive ourselves for our own advantage, from the chilling placebo effect to the universal superstitions. You'll be shocked to know that no matter how sophisticated or realistic you may think you are, you're constantly kidding yourself. Far from mental illness, risky optimism, delusion, and egocentricity can give us a psychological resilience that being realistic cannot. From the boardroom to the bedroom, the way we perceive and deceive reveals a hidden power in us, a power that could lead us to success, health, happiness. Armed with neuroscience and biology, get ready to be shocked. Joseph, welcome.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's actually a pleasure to have you. Now, I want to start off by, I don't know how much that you know about me. I've been doing executive life coaching and neuroplasticity clinical hypnosis for 37 years, probably 120,000 clinical hours. So your book meant a lot to me because there's some things that we totally agree on, some things we don't. I want you to tell me what you mean when you use the word self-deception.
Well, essentially people deceiving themselves about the reality of whatever situation it is they're facing.
Give me an example of that.
Oh, gee. There can be any one of a number of like everyday examples. I guess one of the most common, which probably many of the listeners will relate to, is how much exercise people get. A number of studies have been done. One was just recently done, for instance, in Norway, where they outfitted men and women with little accelerometers, which are little devices they can put on their bodies that actually measure how much exercise you get.
Right.
And then they asked people, well, how much exercise did you get during the week? And then they compared that to what was actually recorded on the accelerometers. And consistent with other studies, they've shown that people vastly overestimate the amount of vigorous exercise they get in a week. I think men, for instance, said they got somewhere around six times as much as the accelerometer showed. Women said they got about five times as much. So they were off by a pretty wide margin.
Joe, so I would...
That's one common example.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. But let me ask you a question.
Sure.
People triage their life. And for the most part, people do not grow up. They grow old. They don't necessarily mature. Some people are more self-reflective because they're not in a constant state of survival. That's why I find people who have the things they need have the time to be more self-reflective. Mm. I want to jump into something that you mentioned. You mentioned Benjamin Franklin discovered the placebo effect. But the question that I have for you as someone who lives for neuroscience is that when one takes a placebo, there is a neurological reaction that actually takes place. So the placebo, even though it is not the drug, it will cause the brain to act as if the drug is there.
Correct. That's not just the drug even, the surgery or other forms of medical intervention like acupuncture. And you mentioned Benjamin Franklin. This was the great debate, lost to history now, but some 200 years ago, where they found that the effects induced by the placebo were often just as good as the effects induced by the so-called real drug or real medical treatment, which raised the question, gosh, if they both work equally well, why is one superior to the other?
Now, in many senses, I think that the placebos are more superior because they don't have the list of side effects, which is interesting. But a lot of it is what we're really talking about is how to manipulate and change a person's self-perception and self-talk within their own brain, that their ability to understand the difference between their rational mind and their emotional brain and their reptilian brain can make all the difference in the world, because most people act out of their emotions and not out of what's rational.
I think that's true, and I think one of the discoveries I made during the course of this book was that people will tend to very broadly kind of lump their life experience into objective events and subjective events, you know, those subjective that they think are related to their psychological makeup. Objective events are just like facts, scientific things that happen to them. And I think a lot more of human experience is subjective than we would kind of give ourselves credit for.
To some degree, and I wonder if you agree with me, Joe, I think everything is subjective to the extent that, unless a great number of people are observing the same thing and 2 + 2 = 4, but then you have a quantum physicist who says, no, 2 + 2 = 4. You know, that could change as well. So I don't know if there's anything as true, complete objectivity.
Well, you know, that's a great philosophical question. In fact, I just happened not long ago to reread George Orwell's great work, 1984. And that's really the central debate of that whole book is there such thing as objectivity? Is there any objective truth or is it all subjective? And he famously says, you know, at some point 2 + 2 = 4, but then there's the counter argument.
Exactly. Does it always equal 4?
So which is 2 + 2 always 4 under all circumstances everywhere in the universe? And, you know, that's the debate he had in that book. And it's one that continues to this day. But I think undeniably a lot more of life than we might acknowledge or want to acknowledge is subjective. It takes place in that 4.5 inches between the temples.
I think that's why I loved your book so much, because what happens is that we have a world of so-called experts. I see hospitals as roach motels. You check in, but you don't check out.
Right.
Where when one's mind could be, in fact, manipulated, and I use that in a very positive term, in a way to believe in its own power of healing and perception and focus and to align itself with a lot more positive thoughts. The reason people don't use placebos, or doctors don't use them, number one, they don't make money from them. And number two, they're afraid of lawsuits.
They're afraid of lawsuits, and yet there was a survey not long ago, I think 4 or 5 years ago, of American doctors, and it found that you know, the majority of American doctors acknowledge at some point having prescribed placebos to their patients. And this is very consistent with findings in other Western countries, you know, Israel, many of the Scandinavian countries, European countries. Doctors there all acknowledge using placebos because even they, you know, so-called men and women of science, even they acknowledge that there's a role that those can play.
Oh, absolutely. And going to the doctor itself is a placebo. You go to the doctor,
sure,
and he looks at you and says, you know what, you're perfect, you're fine, shut up, don't worry. He just, in fact, you walk out feeling better.
No, and in fact, many studies have shown that the doctor, him or herself, is a placebo.
Correct.
Particularly in Western cultures. They go to the doctor, just that fact that you have spoken to him or her, that they've put hands on you, even that has a healing effect. Just that step in and of itself, let alone the pills or the surgery or the other treatments that they prescribe for you.
I completely agree. But I want to point out to those who are listening to us that if your doctor is not positive, if every little thing he wants to just investigate more and more and more, he could turn a perfectly healthy person into a hypochondriac.
Probably could. You know, and there again have been studies that have shown that a positive attitude by the physician is positively correlated to their health and recovery. People respond more quickly, often require fewer painkillers, et cetera, if the doctor is optimistic.
All right, so all your listeners out there, I want you to listen to Joe and I. Let your doctor be positive and really, you know, productive and not look at every little nonsense just to simply get more billing in, and you probably end up being healthier. Tell me about this. Tell me about pain perception.
Sure. Again, many people may think pain is an objective experience. If, you know, I punch you in the nose, it like hurts the same for everyone, but it doesn't. Studies have been done, and they've shown, for instance, that our perception of pain varies with whether or not, for instance, we believe it was inflicted intentionally. So if we think someone, for instance, accidentally tripped us and we fell down and skinned our knee, it might rate a 6 on the pain scale. But if we believe somebody purposely tripped us and we fell down, we would rate it an 8. So even the context in which we experience pain alters our perception of how bad it hurts, which is, I think, probably opposite of what many people would think. They would think it would hurt the same.
And for those who don't believe that, I just want everyone, and it's because it makes so much sense, is that when you're playing with your kids when they're little, you could throw them around, hit them, squeeze them, run them. But when you're angry and you try to, you know, you give them a potch on the backside, then they scream hysterically in pain.
Oh, yeah. Every parent probably knows
exactly
what you're talking about.
It's completely. And one of my favorite characters, obviously, dates my age, you know, plus doing my job for 37 years, was Spock, who basically said there's no such thing as pain. It's all in your mind. If you could simply knock it out of your brain or realize that pain is not a fact, it is an experience that you could rewrite, you could, in fact, be pain-free. And to some degree, that's why hypnosis works good for pain.
Yeah, and there's a great deal of truth in that. You know, as I mentioned in the book, there were studies done of veterans in World War II, for instance, and a very famous anesthesiologist out of Harvard University was shocked when he treated men who had been wounded at Anzio and found that they had terrible wounds, just horrible wounds many times, broken bones, shrapnel, you name it. But they weren't in nearly as much pain as one might have expected. And later, he performed some experiments when he got back stateside, where he tried to basically inflict the same amount of pain on civilians, people who would have major surgery, for instance, in the 1950s, cardiac surgery, things like that. And he compared the amount of painkillers the soldiers asked for versus the amount of painkillers that the civilians asked for. And he found that the civilians experience far more pain and ask for far more painkillers. And his answer for why that was that for many of the soldiers, getting wounded perversely was actually a great thing because it meant they could go home, that they would live through the war and they would be safe. And many of them looked at it that way, sadly as that may be, whereas for the civilians experiencing cardiac surgery in the United States in the 1950s, that was often a horrible, debilitating, permanently life-altering, it might keep you alive, but you wouldn't be in great shape, type of surgery. And so we found out that even something as evanescent as hope, as happiness, can affect the perception of pain.
And that, I think, is really the message. Your perception is everything. The SEALs have an expression that pain is weakness leaving the body.
Sure, yeah, I've heard that.
Okay, and for them, the pain almost makes them want to go on and on and on because it's a productive thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the reasons I personally believe that we have become more and more dependent on drugs, legal and illegal, is that we're so pain averse that we can't see any of the productivity that pain is part of the healing process, or that pain can be dealt with, you know, in your mind, you know, to a certain extent.
And that phrase "dealt with," I think, is important because, as you probably know, one of the key psychological features everybody needs in their life is the perception of control, that they have control over their lives, over various aspects of their lives.
Absolutely.
And it's absolutely critical that you feel, if you have pain, that you have some sort of control over it, that you can control it rather than having it control you. And if a pill gives you that perception, that belief that you now can have some control over the pain, then you lean on the pill.
I mean, that's absolutely true. It is what the mind simply believes. Talk to me a little bit about what happens in mass hysteria and why women are more prone to it.
Yeah, you know, we've heard that phrase mass hysteria and kind of use it fairly loosely, but it's a pretty particularized phenomenon that happens in basically all cultures throughout the globe, and we assign it sometimes a more fancy name like social contagion, where somebody's perception will spread from person to person in a very, very rapidly, very quickly, and often with physical manifestations. Some of your listeners may recall a year or so, maybe a little longer ago, in upstate New York, there were reports of girls in high school up there who started spontaneously developing all sorts of tics and twitches. It got international attention, TV, CNN, all sorts of very bizarre, almost like Tourette syndrome type behavior. And the parents were mystified. Like, these were previously normal girls. And it turned out to have been a case of social contagion. And people are very, very prone to basically catching these kinds of moods from others. And studies have recently come out to show that even on social media, people's moods is they're catchy. They can be transmitted via social media.
I think that's why who you surround yourself with, meaning lots of people are very masochistic in the sense that they feel this obligation to stay around people who actually are so negative that you can't find your own identity. I coined a phrase called TID, temporary identity disorder. It's like when a policeman retires and he's no longer a cop, goes through a depression. When people don't have a strong identity, they are so subject to anxiety and depression and hysteria because they're not focused on their identity, which in and of itself could be a delusion, but at least it works.
Sure. It at least works, and it's astonishing, frankly, when you study this, the seemingly crazy things that people will come to believe is absolutely true. In various parts of the world, Asia and Africa in particular, there are periodically, this goes on, but, you know, every 20 years or so, you'll have what they call penis panics, where men, vast numbers of men, will simply believe their penises have been cut off, that they've been stolen. Crazy, crazy stuff that you must shake your head and think, oh my God, how could anybody believe that? And yet, this is very common. You can look it up. Listeners can go Google it as they hear us talk about it, and you'll find that it's a fairly common thing.
Joe, somebody from this conversation is going to go out and start a insurance company for penis insurance. Just in case you lose your penis, we will replace it. We'll find it. In Romanian, my wife's Romanian, the word mine means liar.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, you know, meaning your mind could lie to you or it could, in fact, position you for great success. But it is important to know our limitations, that we cannot do everything. And very often, people who are very powerful fall into that narcissistic phase where they think because they could do one thing well, they could do everything well, and that's just not the case.
You know, and I might not even put those two in juxtaposition. I would say oftentimes your mind can lie to you, which puts you in a position for success.
Absolutely, 100%.
The two are not mutually exclusive.
In fact, in a sense that it puts you in a position of success because the mind lying is the person believing I can do this, and therefore they take the action that reflects their belief, and even though they don't have the skill set, they eventually get there.
Well, you know, and everybody listening to this will probably relate at some point in their lives where you've basically found it necessary to stave off reality, at least for a little while. When you're trying something very difficult, whether it's, you know, screwing up the courage to go talk to a man or woman in a bar who you might think is out of your league, whether it's attempting to get into that college or graduate program that is very competitive, all sorts of things in life where you think, this might be above me, so I'm going to have to just basically psych myself up for this and maybe believe things about myself that maybe aren't objectively true or aren't objectively quantifiable. You got to, you know, stave off reality a little bit sometimes to get through tough times.
So, Joe, tell me how you've done it in your life. What self-deception have you seen yourself plug into?
I'll give you a small example that actually is supported in some of the research in which some of your listeners can probably do their own test on, and it concerns your performance in high school. A number of studies have been done asking people a very simple question: what was your grade point average in school? And they ask people this, and they particularly do it with college students. The virtue of doing it with college students is they have the college students' transcripts. So they can compare their memory of their grades with their actual real grades. And they found something that is not surprising. Most people remember their grades as being far better than they were. But they weren't puffing. This is the interesting thing.
So they weren't lying. They actually believed it.
They weren't lying. This is the very important distinction. They weren't lying. They actually believed it. And one way they know this is because they then went a step further and tested their recall by letter grade. So, for instance, they looked at when people got an A, they found that people almost never forgot the A. The recall was 89%. But it dropped with each successive letter grade, so that by the time they got down to the D, the recall rate was only 29%. So the brain, in other words, automatically kind of adopted rose-colored glasses.
Now, but they remember
the good thing, the A,
right,
and they forgot the bad grade, the D. So over time, they tended to believe they were better students than they actually were. Now you ask, how does this relate to me? Well, when I read these studies for the book, I was a little bit skeptical, so I went to the attic and pulled out my own report cards. And I kind of remembered myself as an A and B student. So I pull out my report card, and there I see A's and B's, but I see one course, I got a C+.
Oh, my God.
Which is like, well, oh, my God, terrible. See, if one of my kids got a C+, I'd be on them. But I got a C+, and I looked at the course, and it was writing. And I thought, you know, had I gone through life believing I was a C+ writer, I probably never would have become a writer, right? I would have become a, you know, I don't know, accountant or lawyer or something else.
Exactly.
So was there a little self-deception going on there? Probably. Did it benefit me? Arguably.
So I want you to explain this, because here's the irony. The irony is that people, you know, I see people every day, 16, 17 hours a day, and they will remember, they're in their 50s and 60s, and they will still talk about all the hurts and pain and suffering that their friends and their family and their parents have done to them. Why are they not disassociating from those negative memories and just focusing on the positive?
It's a good question. I don't know. You have vastly more experience in that area than I do. Why they're clinging to certain things that maybe they wouldn't or shouldn't cling to.
I'm going
to
tell you
frankly,
why.
Maybe other people in their lives might remember it very differently than they remember.
And I'm going to tell you why the answer to that is. It's kind of, I threw out the question, I'm going to give you the answer.
Okay.
That the rational mind doesn't hold a tremendous amount of emotion, so the rational mind could much more effectively deceive oneself, because you could choose what you choose to believe, but emotionally, you have less control over your emotions. Your frontal lobe is not fully formed, 18 to 25. So your emotions, you don't have control. And in fact, you know, your parents or God and everything that happened to you in the early years affect you more powerfully, because your rational mind just can't put it into, it just can't put it into boxes, which mm-hmm. is why, by the way, we use hypnosis and neuroplasticity to do that. But that is why people are stuck in the past.
Yeah, and I think you're probably familiar with the Grant study at Harvard University, a famous, well-known study that followed basically male Harvard graduates, because at the time the study was initiated, Harvard was all male, from basically the World War II era forward for the rest of their lives, followed them all their lives, physicals every 5 years, very intimate details, interviews, psychological interviews, and basically it found... One of the things it found was that those men who had this kind of rose-colored way of looking at the world ended up being a lot healthier than those who did not.
No, and absolutely. And I am
familiar World War II veterans who had gone through some really bad stuff, you know, had killed people in action, et cetera. It found that over time, just as memories of grades changed and became better than they actually were, their memories of the war began to kind of soften with time, that those fewer the people who remembered killing someone, for instance, started to decline with years. You know, those bad memories started to be getting erased. And the good memories of the war, such that one can have good memories of a war, were there were more of them than they used to have. So over time, they could show quantifiably kind of the memory shifting and correlate that to those people who had basically better physical health at middle age.
And I would add another factor to that, because what happens is it is so much easier to deal with something when you truly believe it's the right thing. And mm-hmm. World War II was such a clear, it was the clearest war we've ever had. You know, maybe with the bombing of Pearl Harbor or whatever the case might be. So therefore, when there is a pride and even a national support for the soldiers and the gratitude and all the laws that passed helping veterans come back, it was easier because their identity was, I did my duty, I served my country. Whereas people coming back from Vietnam didn't have the same experience.
Yeah, without question, the experience was different for those people. It'd be very interesting to track them over their lives as well. But again, you know, the correlation that those people who were able to basically come away with a rosier view of things, that rosier view actually translated into better health, you know, which just reinforces the attitude that sometimes, not every time, but sometimes it's better to be optimistic than it is to be realistic.
You know, the way you think will actually determine the way you feel. And the way you feel will actually then neurologically determine the way things are. Got a question that my producer wanted me to ask you. Why do conspiracy theories endure despite some of them being some not so much, but the ones that are ridiculous?
Yeah, you know, there's all sorts of ones. You know, I saw, for instance, just the other day, even now, today in the United States, and it's been, I think 50 years exactly since President Kennedy was assassinated, more people today believe in the conspiracy theory of Kennedy's death than believed it immediately after Kennedy's death. So the conspiracy theory has kind of grown over time, even though you might think, gosh, more evidence would have filtered out, people would have come to believe that, you know. But for a lot of people, the conspiracy theory fills a void for them, and it also gets back to the little control issue. You know, it is a way of explaining the world that they find satisfying.
I think that's it. I think it makes more sense to them, and therefore the conspiracy theory helps define their sense of the world, giving them more authority, more power, more identity.
It does, you know, and people believe, you know, all sorts of, you know, Sasquatch, you know, UFOs, the list can go on, and I'm sure some people will call in and say, hey, UFOs are real. Well, maybe they are. Loch Ness Monster, too, but people will always graft onto those kinds of conspiracy theories. And the curious thing researchers have found is that many of us think, well, gosh, if you just give people more facts, then they will come to see the light. They will see that their conspiracy theory is nutty and that they're in the wrong. And they'll say, mea culpa, you know, the scales have fallen from my eyes and now I see the world clearly. But they've often found that actually doing that can backfire. It can have the opposite effect. People who believe things deeply, if you expose them to the quote-unquote facts, they often just dig in even more tightly and hold to those beliefs because they feel on some level that what's being challenged isn't just their belief, but them as a person, because that belief is so intricately tied to who they are as a person that you can't challenge one without challenging the other.
Joe, what happens when the conspiracy theory actually turns out to be right in a sense like this, when people will say, you know what, all government does is try to self-sustain itself, and it's not about what a person truly believes, it's what a person could get elected for, and at the end of the day, it's about their own self-interest. Now, that sounds like a conspiracy theory, but to me, it sounds completely true.
Yeah, I personally probably would go along with that. You know, what's one man's truth is another man's conspiracy theory, and vice versa, probably. But yeah, you know, and conspiracy theories die very hard deaths. It can take a long, long, long time to stomp things out. I mean, you know, in the book we cite, for example, the whole issue of bloodletting, you know, just bleeding people.
Right.
Yeah, it was done for 3,000 years ago. People were bleeding, and to this day, even in some situations, people are still, quote-unquote, bled, like you had too much blood, so they slice you open and let you bleed. You know, that I think most doctors would probably poo-poo that today, at least under most circumstances. And yet, that belief has persisted for a long, long time.
And yet, a lot of things that are practiced now, later on, will be seen in the same light.
Oh, without question, much of what goes on in medicine today, 50 or 100 years from now, you know, doctors will shake their heads and think, oh, my God, what were they thinking?
So why are we so adept at spotting faults in others, but horrible at spotting faults in ourselves? That's what most kids ask me about their parents. Don't they see they pick on me, but don't they see they're just as bad?
So
what's the answer to that?
We all tend to be blind to our own blind spots. I think it's part of who we are. We tend not to see those blind spots. For instance, most people in their professional lives will tend to see themselves as being objective, whether in fact they're doctors, lawyers, baseball umpires, you name it. If you ask them, you know, are you fair and impartial in discharging your duties? They would say, oh, absolutely. I'm not influenced by money or race or gender or any of those issues. But basically, every study has shown the opposite to be true. They've shown, for instance, that professional baseball umpires and basketball referees are influenced by questions of race. They've shown, for instance, that doctors are influenced by money, that doctors who have a financial interest in if they own a testing company that will run blood tests, other kinds of tests, they're twice as likely to send their patients to get tested as are doctors who have no financial stake in the outcome of the test.
Oh, Joe, I would say twice as much is really underestimating it.
That may be an underestimate.
That's a real underestimation.
You know, and yet if you challenge those doctors and say, gee, is your patient care dictated by how much money you can make off that patient, they would, you know, they would be outraged that you would even imply such a thing.
Absolutely, and they would throw, if I missed it, if I didn't do this test, there could be a lawsuit and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, well, exactly, and they've demonstrated this. These are economists doing these tests who have shown this, and again, this cuts across. I'm not picking on doctors. This is just a human trait that we are not objective. We're influenced by these things.
Let's pick on lawyers.
Refuse to see them. We pick
lawyers used to get paid. They used to get paid by the word, just by the word. That's how they originally got paid in the 1800s. And now, at the end of the day, for the most part, in almost any, that's why I push people towards mediation, that lawyers have a vested interest not to agree.
Trouble is good.
Yeah, trouble is good, and more trouble is even better. So the longer they could draw things out, you know, then at the end of the day, the more they could get everyone angry at one another, the longer it goes and the more the fees are billed.
Well, if you and I have nothing to fight about, we don't need lawyers, right?
Exactly.
Right. You know, but if we're going to bicker, you know, ad infinitum, then you got to rope in the lawyers. You argue, I argue, we file briefs, you file briefs, and it goes on forever until, as Dickens found, you know, the estate is exhausted, and then everything stops.
When the money runs out, the lawyers don't return phone calls. And I treat, you know, a lot of good lawyers. There are good lawyers out there, but they're not in the majority. They're probably not in the majority of my fans either, but that's a different story.
Well, I'll say one good word about lawyers because I'm married to one. So I know there's at least one good one.
Yeah, no, there are great ones. And that's really true. And those great ones, unfortunately, because they won't play the games and they won't sell their souls, they don't become the judges, because they don't become the ones who have the power or the authority. But there are people who actually believe that justice should be done.
Yeah. Thank God.
Thank God for that. So let me ask this question. How much of a false belief is a matter of neurological deception that could happen to anyone, and how much of it is socioeconomic?
How much of it? Boy, that's I'm going to have to try to think about that. I don't know that I can give like a clear-cut 60-40, 50-50 answer. I mean, I forget who said it a long time ago, but they said where you stand on an issue depends on where you sit.
Right, and that's...
You know, and things may look different to you if you're driving a BMW versus, an old jalopy. People will look at you differently. And have you even found, for instance, that people's driving habits vary according to the car they drive? People who drive fancy cars have been shown to basically run stop signs more often, basically be aggressive on the road, kind of, you know, try to throw their weight around, so to speak, rather than people who drive more modest cars. So there certainly is a socioeconomic factor, but how much is neurological versus socioeconomic? Good question.
You know, and I would say it's to a great extent, because what happens is that when people feel that they lack power and they're disempowered, then it does do something to their neurology. It does do something to their lack of willingness to change their lives, just like depression. Mm-hmm. You know, and when people are in poor areas, you know, they tend to follow, it's more of a pack mentality. And when people who are a little bit wealthier, their kids are going to different schools, having different experiences, having different sets of friends, and therefore they tend to think a little bit.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting. Some of the studies I've seen, and there's quite a few studies, and I'm sure other people have seen other studies that point in different directions, but the studies I've seen fairly consistently point to people with low socioeconomic conditions, poor people, for lack of a better phrase, are much more attuned to their environment than are rich people. For, again, lack of a better phrase, we'll just put this in stark contrast here, rich versus poor. And if you think about it, it makes a certain amount of sense, because if you're poor, you're vulnerable. One small upset in your world can be calamitous for you. So you have to be very sensitive to your surroundings to perceive what may be around the corner for you. Whereas if you're Mr. Rich Guy, you are to a degree more or less impervious. You wreck your car, no big deal. Your insurance is going to cover it. You know, you get hurt, you got health insurance, it's going to cover that. So the rich people tend to be more inward focused, kind of basically care about their opinion more, whereas poor people, studies have shown, tend to be much more sensitive to their surroundings and to other people's actions than the rich people are.
I think that's true, and I think it's even heightened when they're poor people who are part of the community. Because not only are they sensitive, but at the end of the day, they feel like they're there to help one another out. And therefore, to some extent, I find that people who are middle class or lower middle class have many more friends than wealthy people. Wealthy people have a billion acquaintances, but no one they trust. And I actually found the happiest person in terms of wealth, because I deal with tremendous amount of wealthy people, is those who have a net worth of $50 million are that much more happier than someone who's a billionaire or worth $300-400 million.
Because peaks about 50.
Yeah, the 50 is the number. They feel like they're safe enough that they're not going to blow up, and they still need to work and want to work.
Yep. Okay, I can buy that.
For $50 million,
I got a ways to go, but I can buy it.
You know, let's hopefully, you know, the two of us, when we have that, just have this discussion and see if it's true.
Yeah, well, exactly. We'll compare happiness quotas.
So tell me about, you know, about how you personally, you know, when you were writing this book, What was in it for you? What did you want to accomplish from it?
I'll start at the beginning. The book grew out of a previous book I'd written called Why We Make Mistakes. And in a book, I showed a bunch of common human errors, many of which were caused by issues of self-deception. People would kid themselves about various things and usually make calamitous mistakes as a result of that. And, you know, one of the big ones, for instance, that you can look at, this is not on an individual basis, but on a very large global basis, for instance, with the whole weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We thought they were there. We go in Iraq. We find out they're not there. As a result, we launched this big war, consequences of which we're still dealing with today, all these years later. Very often we'll make mistakes because we deceive ourselves about our own abilities, about other people, all sorts of forms of self-deception. I thought, why would that trait, that human trait towards self-deception, persist? Why wouldn't it be weeded out of the gene pool like so many other useless traits over the years? Why would, you know, the people who are self-deceivers not simply just basically die out of the gene pool?
I think your book is everyone should read your book. I mean,
well,
because
thank you.
Because it really does help you realize that you could grow to whatever potential you want if you use your mind and not so much your emotions. I would just comment, by the way, we didn't lose the war in Iraq. We lost the peace. We're very good at winning wars. We're very bad at keeping peace.
Oh, yeah. Things have not exactly a peaceful place there, I think. Everybody would probably agree on that, regardless of their initial position on the war or subsequent position. But you look at that, and I looked and said, well, why would people continue to deceive themselves, even though we've been warned by people from the Greeks onward not to deceive ourselves? And I basically found out that we deceive ourselves because self-deception is, under certain circumstances, good for us. And people say, oh, gosh, how could it be good? And I say, well, it's like cholesterol. You got good cholesterol, you got bad cholesterol. A certain amount of self-deception works like the psychological immune system.
Well, it's also part of the evolutionary process that self, self-deception is part of how we are evolving, and that people like to believe there's an absolute truth, but that in and of itself is self-deception.
Yeah, and I think, it is evolutionary, and other scholars have weighed in on this, because what self-deception can do under the right circumstances is basically keeps you in the game. It keeps you swinging. If you need to believe something, self-deception gets you there. If you're trying something difficult, if you're an athlete going up to a home plate and you have to swing and there's 50,000 people staring at you, those things can help. There was a study, for instance, in Germany about 2 years ago where they gave two groups of people a golf ball and asked them to go putt the golf ball. One group was just given a regular ball and said, go putt. The other group, though, was given a ball and said, this ball has been lucky so far. This was total BS, but it's what they were told. And then they measured the putting performance of each group. And they found that those people who were putting with the ball that they believed to be lucky were actually much better putters than the people who were just given a regular ball. And they repeated this with a number of other tasks and found the same trend. Basically, if you believe you have an edge, that in itself becomes the edge.
And that's why I say if you change your mind, you change your life.
Exactly. Yeah. So within reason, you can sit and wish you were 8 feet tall and you're not going to be 8 feet tall, but you can be a better golfer.
So let me throw out a completely different question.
Sure.
Time is closing in. Why do men who appear to have it all, Tiger Woods, John Edwards, Lance Armstrong, why do they risk everything by doing so stupid thing?
Yeah, this is a real chestnut in the news. I spent many years as a newspaper reporter, and you would see, incredibly well-known, rich, powerful, famous people do incredibly stupid things. You think, good Lord, what were they thinking? And really what happens is they're manifesting a trait we all have. We're all what they call risk optimists. People, even very smart people, will acknowledge the generalized risk of doing an activity. Smoking, for instance. Most people will say, smoking is terrible for your health, you get cancer, et cetera. And yet people still smoke. If you ask people about sexually transmitted diseases, they'll say, oh, yes, terrible, terrible problem. The very people wear condoms. And it turns out that what happens is most people think, yeah, the odds of divorce or any bad thing happening, I know what those are, but I don't believe those odds apply to me. And it's a very key thing to understand about the way people see themselves versus society as a large.
And what I would add to that,
society at risk, but not themselves.
What I would add to that is that men who throw everything away are usually those who don't have a lot of real friends around them who they could be open and honest, and they're not afraid, to speak about their weaknesses and get some balance.
That's probably true. Many of these studies you see, there's nobody to call them and have a beer with and say, hey, dude, this is dumb. Don't do this thing.
So what's the difference between how we see ourselves and how people see us?
Yeah, the examples have been given basically, and this is going to be a little bit generalizing, but we tend to see others as sheep, that they just kind of go along with the crowd, follow the herd, just kind of move along. And we tend to see deep down our own selves as kind of like the Marlboro Man, kind of a loner, making up our own minds, master of our own fate, captain of our own ship, that kind of distinction. So we tend to see ourselves as more, masters of our own destiny than other people. That's kind of the big distinction.
I'm going to agree with that, but I'm going to throw in something else. I want to know what you think about it, Joe. I think that there's also, because there's so much self-deception going on, and some of it they're aware of, there's a degree of self-hatred, and self-sabotaging provides a new challenge.
Yeah, well, that may well be. You know, it's interesting. If you just ask people, economists have done this, and it's pretty interesting. You just ask people what they will pay for something. Doesn't matter what. iPad, French lessons, trip to the moon, perfect teeth, whatever. Ask them what they'll pay for it. And then ask them what they think other people will pay for it. And when this study has been done, they found out that people very consistently think they will pay less for an item than the other guy will.
Very,
I think the other guy is kind of more or less a dupe and will end up paying more for the same thing that they're going to be a very canny business person about.
Joe, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It's fascinating. Your books are fascinating. We're going to promote the hell out of it. And you're just doing great work. Just keep on going.
Well, thanks, Dr. Luck. I appreciate it.
You have a great day, Joe.
Hey, you too.
I want to once again thank our wonderful guest, Joseph Hallinan, for coming onto our show. Everyone, go pick up a copy of his book, Kidding Ourselves, The Hidden Power of Self-Deception. It's on Amazon.com. Also, while you're at it, visit his website, josephhallinan.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Now, I want you to go check out our other episodes. I want you to go to gluckradio.com, and I want you to go on your Twitter list and make everyone listen to it, because we're exploding. If you think you have a story to be told, if you think that you have something that could change other people's lives, then you get in touch with my office, and maybe we'll put you on the show. Keep listening. Keep sending us your feedback. Till next time.